Here in America, work is in trouble. We've offshored our manufacturing, sent away good jobs, and lost so much ability to make things. American Giant is pushing back against that tide. They make high-quality clothing for a summer wardrobe you'll love, all made right here in the USA. Support America's workers and get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code STAPLE20.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
But first, Tánaiste Micheál Martin, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, we want to talk about the budget in a little while, but, you know, we are fiddling while Rome burns if the world is at war.
I think it's very serious, and the it has escalated regionally, and the prospects for further escalation are there. The Iranian attack on Israel raises the bar very high, in my view. And you know, Iran has been a malign actor for a long time within in the Middle East, supporting its proxies in terms of Hamas and Hezbollah. And we've had the horrific Hamas attack in October the 7th last year, followed by, in my view, disproportionate and excessive attack on Gaza, with horrific consequences for the civilian population of Gaza, and women, children, and innocent people being killed, and the entire sort of way of life there destroyed to such an extent that the UN are saying the population are on the verge of famine. Now we're in Lebanon with a million people displaced. And what I feel in terms of the overall situation is the lack of any strategic sense of where all of this is going. And ultimately, there has to be a political pathway developed. There has to be a peace pathway developed, because ultimately all of the people living in the Middle East have to live in harmony alongside of each other.
We're all trying to figure out what really is going on. I mean, the activities of Israel are such that there was bound to be a retaliation from Tehran at some point. I mean, don't forget, they actually sent a missile into Tehran themselves in July. So they have attacked Iranian sovereign territory. So you wonder, is this part of the game plan? Is this what you contemplate? Is this Netanyahu just looking for the excuse to raise the stakes and maybe go after Tehran's nuclear capabilities?
Some analysts are saying that this that from an Israel military perspective, that this may present an opportunity.
Yeah.
In terms of dealing with Hezbollah, dealing with Hamas, and dealing with Iran. But I think that's a high-risk strategy in my view, but also has devastating consequences for ordinary people living in the region. And when I was at the United Nations the week before last, I was struck by the real sort of worry and concern amongst the Egyptians and the Jordanians in terms of the impact of this on their populations, the actual real prospect of instability in the region spreading far and wide in their own countries. They're now looking at a prospect of mass exodus of Palestinians into their territories, which they do not agree.
They've had a détente with Israel for decades now, both Jordan and Egypt. Yep. They may be asked by others in the region, make up your mind, whose side are you on?
Well, that's the pressure they are now under. Remember the large Palestinian population in Jordan, and the government is coming under pressure. They're tearing their hair out in some respects at 30 years of peace, and as you said, détente, and relations had improved immeasurably between Israel, Egypt and Jordan. And they feel there's almost a reckless sort of lack of any consideration of the implications of all of this escalation of conflict and war, and particularly in terms of the impact on their own societies and countries, but on the wider region more generally. And then that, of course, impacts globally, because trade in the Red Sea is below 50% now of what it was. We're not all immune.
The longer journey means higher prices.
Higher costs and higher prices.
For everybody. Yeah. Meantime, we have our own particular small part to play in all of this, because we have our peacekeepers in UNIFIL who are literally on the front line of those Israeli incursions into southern Lebanon.
Absolutely. And that is a big worry and concern, although our troops are safe, they're professional, they work with thousands of others in UNIFIL. And I've had talks with varying European Union contributing countries, Spain and France in particular, United Kingdom as well, in terms of our civilians within Lebanon, Irish citizens in Lebanon. But more generally, in terms of the UNIFIL troops, I mean, I met in the United Nations with Jean-Pierre Lacroix, who's the Under Secretary for Peacekeeping. to go through all the various scenarios. Our troops are safe where they are right now, and probably safer there than in terms of moving about Lebanon at this stage, given the volatility and level of activity that's going on in terms of bombing and so on like that. Spoke to the chief of staff this morning. They're safe. They're well. They bunkered down last evening. They are the eyes and ears of the international community now in terms of Lebanon. We've seen in past conflicts, if there's any unilateral sudden exodus of peacekeepers from any given region, it can lead to even worse atrocities and so forth.
Well, Hezbollah are probably somewhat rudderless after the decimation of the leadership, but still, they've more or less said to the Israelis, come into our parlour if you wish, at your peril.
They have. I'm not a military expert or analyst, but certainly the Hezbollah command structure has been decimated in the last while. But my overall concern is where is it all leading? And the level of hate that has been stoked up in the region is something that will last a long time. I mean, what has happened in Gaza is not something that can be picked up very quickly afterwards and put together again. So there's going to be a very lingering, bitter legacy of hate and division in the region. And that will probably stoke up more radicalized opinion in the region. So I don't see where ultimate security comes from through the raging of war. And I think the war has to stop. I think the hostages have to be released. And I think that an enormous effort now must go into de-escalating the entire situation.
But is that possible if we don't really understand Netanyahu's game plan? And in terms of our forces in UNIFIL, I mean, Israel has shown itself in Gaza, if you want to use the metaphor, the UN as the blue helmets or the blue berets, whatever it might be. No, Israel is not a respecter of that, even though they will quote a UN resolution which allows them to try to sanitize that area south of the Litani River.
I think there is, in terms of UNIFIL generally, I think Israel military would be conscious of the role of UNIFIL, and I think would respect the role of UNIFIL.
You hope?
In terms, I believe they would. In terms of how they conduct whatever their operations they conduct, and UNIFIL have been in constant contact with the IDF and indeed with Hezbollah and other actors to respect the role of peacekeepers more generally, and so far that is held in terms of
even the term you use there, we all use it, peacekeepers, and you're looking at the region, there's no peace there. And so what peace are they keeping?
But it's the level, correct. I mean, the situation is now, is a full-blown escalated situation. Well, it's not a full-blown on-ground war yet. There has been incursions, somewhat limited, in real terms. It's very significant and horrific bombing of Lebanon. 2,000-pound bombs landing in densely populated areas. But the peace, I mean, the peacekeepers were there. I think they were a significant deterrent to conflagration and so on like that and the worsening of the situation. But it has been an imperfect peace. And Hezbollah had significant strength and dominance in the south of Lebanon. We have no government in Lebanon. We have a caretaker government. We have a collapsed economy. The people of Lebanon cannot take a war of any consequence.
But it'll be imposed upon them, perhaps.
It's been imposed right now on them with I think, horrific consequences for them.
Now, you were in the UN, and it strikes us, looking at the UN now, it appears, because of the structure of the Security Council, that it's fairly toothless. I mean, Russia's got the veto in terms of any possible progress on Ukraine, and America has the veto in terms of any possible sanction or censure of Israel.
The Security Council is paralysed and has been for most of the while in respect of not just the Middle East, but other conflicts. There was a breakthrough, I think, in terms of the resolution in relation to a peace formula for Gaza, which neither Hamas or Israel have taken up. But it is, largely speaking, paralyzed. It needs urgent reform. It's past its sell-by date in respect of a post-World War II structure.
But the
which
idea
bears no relationship to the
of the permanent
world
members
of
having
today.
Vetoes on anything. And
yes.
Okay, the General Assembly can pass a motion, but so what?
And that's why I've been not suggesting, I will be bringing forward amendments to the triple lock, because the idea that Ireland's participation in peacekeeping missions in the future would depend on the Security Council that now has the exercise of the veto as the first response, as opposed to
something that should be a last resort. Do we have a plan to extricate our troops if necessary, if all-out war breaks out and there's no role anymore?
We have planned various scenarios with troop contributing countries. And we go through all scenarios, and UNIFIL at the senior command, and that's why I went to UN headquarters last week to exactly focus on that specific issue. But for now, the clear preference of all of the countries who are contributing is to stay put, to commit to peacekeeping in Lebanon, because various scenarios can unfold. We might get a de-escalation yet. I mean, we should not give up hope. The international community has to do everything it possibly can to leverage and to try and create pressure to get all actors to de-escalate as quickly as possible. I do know the United States are putting a lot of pressure on to try and get de-escalation. The European Union is likewise behind the scenes. And that will have to continue, because there is no future, in my view. There are short-term gains to be had, maybe. Some of the actors might think there are short-term gains to be had from military engagement, but long-term, the people will be the loser.
When you look at the map of the Middle East, I invite any of our listeners to Google a map of the Middle East, and you're imagining there's the mighty Israel and the timorous opponents. But then you look at the size and the populations. Mm. Israel is tiny. Absolutely. What it has is a nuclear arsenal and a huge backup, military backup from the United States. But it's in a powerless position. And the idea that that tiny little area of the Middle East could literally control the whole area, it just beggars belief.
You see, that's how I've always analysed it as well. I mean, which is the point I'm making in terms of ultimate long-term security that depends on good relationships with your neighbours. And like, Iran has been behaving in a malign manner for many years in endeavouring to undermine Israel. That has to be said as well. And let's be clear-eyed about that, and in terms of the use of Hezbollah and in terms of the use of Hamas, both of whom have held back good governance, respectively, in Lebanon and in Gaza.
I mean, the money that is spent on armaments and armies might be better spent on improving the lot of the civilian population.
Correct, 100%. And that was what was, I mean, in terms of the normalization of relationships and the development of good relations between Egypt, Jordan and Israel, or at least working relationships between them, all that now is at risk. And I think your basic point is correct. I don't think a military solution long term will cut it alone. And yes, Israel has technological and military superiority. But ultimately, one can't have total security or peace and going about your lives without really sorting out your nearest neighbours and those who live amongst you. And that's why I can never understand the strategic sort of approach of Israel in respect to the Palestinian population. I don't believe it's possible, if that's what the Israel view is. And I've asked Israel straight up, and so has Ayman Safadi and others in the Arab Peace Initiative, what is your strategic agenda in the end of the day? How are you going to deal with millions of Palestinians who live in the West Bank and in Gaza? Do you really think you're going to expel them all into Jordan or across the Rafah border into Egypt? You can't. That's not feasible. And so you need to look at how you give or deal with self-determination for Palestinians, but also work out the structures that would enable Palestinians, future generations of Palestinians and Israelis, to live in peace and in close neighbourliness. That's the only way. We've learned that in Northern Ireland ourselves. It's not as complex as maybe the Middle East politics is, but a lot of the principles around the Northern Ireland peace process do apply in terms of parity of esteem, dual citizenship, all sorts of initiatives, and it needs fresh thinking to bring about that sort of scenario.
Now meanwhile, we have a bonanza of a budget yesterday, and overnight when I saw those 200 missiles flying towards Israel, I'm thinking maybe all of this is going to come to nothing. Price of oil rockets because of a major war in the Middle East. Supply lines are disrupted and maybe destroyed. The whole thing could fall apart.
The geopolitics of the world is the big threat to our economic model, because we're an exporting country. We're a free trade country. We export most of what we produce in goods and services. If you look at the Red Sea, as we discussed earlier, trade down, huge risks attached to it, costs going up. So that is the big worry. And that's why by the end of next year, we will have $16 billion put into the Ireland Future Fund and in the Investment Climate Nature Fund. It's why we're investing more in infrastructure through the EIB share money of $3 billion into water, into housing and into the energy grid, which is going to be key to our economic future. And it's why there is a heavy focus on infrastructure for the future and on third level education. The $150 million from the National Training Fund per annum now going into core funding of universities is a big breakthrough, which again speaks to the research economy and an economy that depends very much on people and human capital. So those are the most serious elements of the budget lost in the cost of living.
The price of energy, could rocket.
It could rocket. I acknowledge that. And it's something that we have to factor in. And it could change, as the Ukraine war did, for a period.
But the problem that you have electorally is that the election, whether it's in November or February, it's in relatively short order. So if there is an oil crisis and a price crisis, therefore, all the good that the budget may have done you becomes undone in advance of an election.
Well, I mean, paradoxically, oil is coming down and it's been a factor in the reduction in inflation primarily, although core inflation is also coming down. But one has to operate in terms of the projections that were given and the macroeconomic projections that we have from the Department of Finance, which are positive for the next 4 to 5 years. But yes, a big war, particularly in the Middle East.
It's events, dear boy, events, isn't it?
It's events can trip you up. And I mean, we saw with the Ukraine war, the sudden reduction in dependence on Russian oil and gas by other European countries caused huge pressure on the market and prices went up exponentially, which led to a massive inflation here in Ireland, which is why we've brought in the cost of living package to try and cope with some of that or help people to cope with that.
How do you respond to the charge? This is buying the election or attempting to. I mean, there's no result until
correct.
It happens.
I mean, I think we should always be wary of the sophistication of the Irish electorate. I mean, I think people will make up their own minds. What is clear, Pat, from a lot of research and just talking to people on the doors, they do feel that they feel the impact of the last 3 years of inflation coming out from the war in Ukraine and energy. People, prices are at an elevated, I think it's up 19 points over 3 years. So people feel elevated prices. They feel it on their daily groceries. They go to the till, heating and so on like that. So it has taken time to try and to try and deal with that. And this budget is significant in the cost of living package to try and help families in particular cope with the extra costs. Now, we've done other things like the free school books, for example, hot school meals, reducing the healthcare costs in terms of the
drug medicine
threshold.
Now, these are ongoing
costs
expenses
we've reduced, which help people to deal with the cost of living more generally.
No, but if things go pear-shaped, those costs are still there. And increases in any of the social welfare, they remain. Whereas things like energy, €250 in energy credits, which is very welcome, I'm sure, you can always stop those in future years.
Yes.
If you're in trouble.
Correct.
But the ongoing rises that you've done in every social welfare category, they remain. So you're accruing expenses for the future.
We've increased core expenditure and this year close to in the high 6.9 percent or 6.9 billion in core in both capital and current expenditure. But even with a growing population and growing infrastructural needs, it's arguable that it is required, that is needed. And in terms of access to healthcare, that the Oireachtas laid out a pathway in terms of reducing costs and improving access to both medicines and the hospitals,
sure,
more generally.
And
that does take, that results in cost. But we thankfully have been in a position where we've had surpluses. We're putting the windfall surpluses into the future funds, which will, I think, hopefully future-proof us for the future in terms of demographic impacts, in terms of pension costs and future healthcare costs, because we're living longer and living older and so forth.
And, and we know we have particular demographic problems, but the health budget got more money yesterday. It's bigger again than it was last year. And yet we're told, in terms of the investment per head between private health insurance and what the government gives to the HSE, we put more money in than virtually any other developed country, and we don't seem to get the bangs for the buck.
I'd imagine the US probably do more, but I do think, I take your point, we do need to get better bang for the buck. I think productivity is an issue in the last number of years, and I think we have to, and the minister is very focused on that in terms of greater transparency, hospital by hospital, as to inputs and outputs, and the need to get higher levels of productivity in terms of the investment we're putting in, because it is about $25.5 billion now. In 2025, going into our health service. Now, on the plus side, we are living longer. Our lifespan has dramatically improved in 20 years. All of that isn't just down to a health investment. It's better quality of life, diet and all the rest. But it does speak to better interventions in terms of stroke, cardiovascular health, cancer treatments, much better than they would have been. That costs a lot of money. The drugs and oncology are huge costs. And investment in hospitals is having impact in terms of we living longer and living. I mean, we've done tremendous work on stroke in this country in eliminating death and serious sort of disability from stroke, and likewise with heart disease and so on like that. So, it does absorb enormous sums of money. I think women's health has improved dramatically in the last 4 years. I give a lot of credit to Stephen Donnelly for what he has done there. We're now moving to free HRT and expansion in terms of the IVF, which are things we never could do in previous years. Yeah. And I think there are positives for women, along with menopause clinics and you know, many other provisions for women's health, which I think is positive.
Now, all the good news, there are people who cavil about what happened yesterday. For example, some of the people who work here who would be above the minimum wage, but not quite at the level where they might have benefited from the higher level of entering the higher tax rate. And they get a little break on the USC, but not much else for that single cohort of medium-paid worker who's not paying the high rate of tax. So it looks like the budget was really aimed at the so-called squeeze middle, the couples, young couples with families who will benefit in all sorts of ways and be many thousands of euro better off.
Everybody benefits. But actually, if you look at the switch model that the ESRI do in terms of progressivity and that, the lowest income deciles 1 and 2 benefit the most from this budget. But you have identified a group
that you'd hope would vote for you in between
30 and 40.
You haven't wooed them.
But many of them are outside the income tax net or pay very low income tax, so they don't benefit necessarily from the widening of the bands or and they're on the lower weight of tax. So I get that. The USC will help there. Working family payment will help in terms of the lump sums on that, as will the child benefit, the double payments, the free book schemes. They're all. I remember, as a broadcaster, every September, people on shows about being ripped off with school books and so on like that. That's now gone in terms of an incredible achievement, I think, in the last 2 to 3 years or before he's brought in.
Not before time, because it was in Northern Ireland forever.
Yeah, but we've done it. No, you know, and it's a significant achievement of this government. Hot school meals going into every school. All that will help families, even those on the incomes that you've identified.
Now, I remember in a previous life doing phone-ins the day after the budget with various ministers for finance. And it was, I think, at the time of the Celtic Tiger. And we had the former Taoiseach, but he was then the Minister of Finance, Brian Cowan, coming in. And he said, "I don't know what I'm doing here. There is no bad news. What are they going to complain about?" This was, he didn't say this on air. He said it off air. And, of course, we had questions for him. But then we had the crash. So all this, you know, buoyant optimism can go off the rails.
Yeah, I worry about that. I mean, I do.
Because the fiscal council said more of a vision than...
I said to my colleagues during the week that, you know, we've got to be very clear here that we are very dependent on corporation tax. We are very dependent on a small number of companies. And that is why we're putting the future Ireland... And fairness to Michael McGrath did put in the legislation, which is about, I think, 0.8% of our GDP will now... every year legislatively go into a fund. We want to get that to 100 billion by the end of the decade. And that will give some protection for the future and for shocks and so forth. And that's why, you know, we came under a lot of pressure on the VAT 9 and so on, but that would have taken the 550 million of revenue out. At a time when we were doing a net tax package for individual taxpayers of $1.4 billion.
But I mean, you see it even in Cork. You've seen a famous chipper close. I'm not sure the reason for that.
I think all over the place they're closing.
Yeah,
but I think we have to deal with the cost side of that. And I think that's, I think we have imposed cumulatively a lot of costs on small businesses. We've got to review that, particularly the convergence of the minimum wage to the living wage by 2026. I think that it means by definition that the Low Pay Commission has to increase minimum wage higher than it normally would. I mean, there are issues. There's no point in pretending they're not. The report done by Detty shows retail and hospitality suffer the most for those costs. But I'm just making the point that we're trying to protect our revenue base as best we can in terms of how we devise the budgets to prepare for shocks in the future. And I'm very conscious of that. And I think the investment in infrastructure, in third level education, do protect us for the competitiveness of the economy into the future, and good measures for startup companies in terms of the enterprise economy.
Energy, transport, the infrastructure we need for offshore wind and so on, all of that must be invested in. But when you look at the unfortunate confluence of the CAG's report coming out and exposing profligacy on the part of the OPW in so many ways, and we see what's going on with the children's hospital, the ability of the state to actually get value for money is in question. And you're thinking, if the people who are pitching for state work know how much money you have in the coffers, and they do, the Apple money, they'll try and get what we used to call the U2 price for everything. You know, if you see Bono walking in the door, the price of the Apple doubles.
Abba Bonner was sensible enough to, in terms of
to go to another shop.
but I think the Apple money hasn't been allocated. No, we've identified where we think it should go. And that's another point. I mean, if we were really profligate...
But you know what I mean? Looking at the value for money, people
the value
say
for money, piece, sorry,
the state doesn't
and that's
do
why,
it.
That's why you need a control in Auditor General, and that's why independently it calls out bad projects and projects that are excessive. On the other hand, there are very good projects we've done. The National Broadband Plan is done. Thousands of houses have been built. Some very good schools. I mentioned some already today in terms of Skull, Virgon Small and Blarney. 1,000 school, 30-odd million done and dusted. The Dunkettle Interchange, for example. Huge engineering challenge there. That has been delivered with huge improvements. The Mike Holland Bypass. And so a lot of good, there's good and bad, and there's a lot of good projects that need to be referenced as well. Primary care clinics, about 175 now in operation. Some very good ones recently in Killeshandra, in Ballincollig. So there's a plus side here where a lot of good projects have been done well, but those ones, the bike shed, in my view, shouldn't have happened, and it's excessive. Problem with security. Security tends to, once people mention security, it does seem to be open sesame in terms of what you've just said there, that no one looks at the bottom line with security. So therefore, my understanding is lots of stuff underground there, underground in terms of connecting in with the wider complex of government buildings. But in any event, value for money is important. I referenced that in the health service. We do need to squeeze that more to get better value, better productivity, better output. And like we've put in at place, like the public spending code, many people have criticised that for slowing down projects because of
the tendering process is so tedious.
Yeah, and all the gates one has to go through. People have criticised us on housing in terms of the number of stages local authorities have had to go through. So on the one hand, we get people saying, would you free it all up, please, so we can get projects done faster? And then, of course, you have hits, genuine issues raised in terms of excessive spending on projects that should not have cost as much.
Now, the cynics are saying, you know, Fianna Fáil, because of the Fine Gael candidates are not that well known because of so many TDs that have decided not to run again, that Fianna Fáil, based on the polls, might end up as the biggest party in the next government, and we'd have a rotating Taoiseach once again, and you'd be in the frame for the first section of any term. After that, you go to the park.
Well, I mean, first of all, I don't take anything for granted. But if one is Taoiseach in the first term after this, there's no park, Pat.
I mean, no, I'm saying Michael D. Then
think it through. I mean, but in fairness,
you ruled it out before. Are you still ruling it out?
Yeah, I'm going for. I want to be Taoiseach after the next general election. That's my aim and objective. And I'm going to go for it. But I think it's wide open. And in my view, I think the dynamic of a campaign is the key determinant of what happens. I saw that in 2020. All the polls beforehand didn't work out, didn't happen the same as the local election. So I think how the campaign evolves when it happens is going to be key. I think from the Fianna Fáil, right now we need to focus on the finance bill, the social protection bill. I think we do need to get the mental health bill through. People want us to be serious about what we're about. The gambling bill, years gone into it, it needs to get through.
You're going to try and get all of this done before,
I want all of that done before
a spring election.
Yeah.
That's your ambition.
That's my
stated ambition.
Yeah.
But the park?
Well, no, that doesn't come into it because I want to be Taoiseach.
No, but I'm
going for Dáil Éireann for the next 4 years. So
you're committed to that?
I'm committed to that. I'm putting myself before the people. I mean, you can't be, that's my view.
Okay, but you're not ruling it out sometime in the future?
Pat, I need a life to it sometime in the future.
Donna DeMeon Martin, thank you very much for joining us in studio today.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Americans are durable. We take pride in hard work and high quality. American Giant makes durable, quality clothing right here in the USA. Because what we wear reflects who we are. When you buy American Giant, you're not just wearing the best clothes money can buy. You're helping keep jobs and pride in your own backyard. Premium clothing built to last decades, like it should. Get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code RIGHTHERE24.